This is not just about books. This is about, you know, really the marginalization of LGBTQ voices, of Black voices, of women's voices. This is about whose stories get to be told.
To decide that for an entire community, what can and cannot be available on the shelves is, to me, you know, an invasion of my rights as a parent that feels very un-American. Fear can be weaponized, and what a powerful motivator it is.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Ukrainian gay couple wins first fight for legal recognition. Puerto Rico bans pediatric gender-affirming care and outlaws practitioners. And writers fight back against U.S. book bans. Those stories and more this week because you found This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm David Hunt.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 19, 2025. A gay Ukrainian couple has won recognition as a legal family in a Kyiv district court. The country's first-of-its-kind precedent was originally reported on June 10th in the Kyiv Independent. Zaryan Keys is a diplomatic employee stationed in Tel Aviv at Ukraine's Israeli embassy. His longtime male partner, Timur Livchuk, was not allowed to join Keys in Tel Aviv because Ukrainian law does not recognize the relationship of a same-gender couple. The couple had a commitment ceremony in their homeland in 2017, then legally married in the United States in 2021. They sued the foreign ministry in 2024, charging that the couple's spousal rights were being violated. They documented their 12-year relationship with joint travel records, photographs, correspondence, and witness testimony to back up their claim. The court concluded that the couple is, in fact, in a de facto civil marriage. Keyes' celebratory Facebook post called the district court decision a very big and important step toward marriage equality in Ukraine, and a small victory in our struggle for simple family happiness for Ukrainian diplomats.
So-called homosexual practice is no longer described as especially dishonorable in a teaching document aimed at prospective Church of England clergy. A meeting of the General Synod voted to amend the 1991 document on sexuality that required clergy to affirm that description. It also urged queer Christians to be celibate. An overwhelming majority of the bishops, clergy, and lay delegates decided on July 15th that the tone, language, and some of the assumptions in the Issues in Human Sexuality document are now contextually inappropriate and appear prejudicial and offensive to many people. Out gay London Anglican priest Charles Bonchick Bell told Reuters that eliminating the word dishonorable opens the way for liberalization of the church's policy on same-sex relationships, and means we can stop using it as a kind of reference text. Church doctrine prohibiting same-gender sex has not changed. However, the Church of England is the parent of the worldwide Anglican Communion, and the move will certainly exacerbate the rift between it and the traditionalist Anglican congregations, primarily in Africa and Asia. That chasm widened in 2023 when Church of England officials decided to allow priests to bless same-gender couples.
Puerto Rico now bans hormone therapy and other gender-affirming care for trans patients under the age of 21 and criminalizes medical providers for breaking the law. Violators face up to 15 years in prison, a $50,000 fine, and revocation of professional licenses and permits. Republican Governor Jennifer Gonzalez Colon signed the bill on July 16th that also prohibits the use of public funds for such care. Puerto Rico's LGBTQ+ Federation President Pedro Julio Serrano wrote, "What a shame. With her actions, Gonzalez Colon declares herself the most anti-equity governor in history." In the legislation's words, it's justified because minors having not yet reached the necessary emotional, cognitive, and physical maturity are particularly vulnerable to making decisions that can have irreversible consequences. Therefore, it is the state's duty to ensure their comprehensive well-being. Although several U.S. states ban pediatric gender-affirming care, the U.S. Island Territories law is seen as much harsher because of its threatened prosecution of medical providers. Puerto Rico's professional associations representing physicians, surgeons, psychologists, social workers, and lawyers had all lobbied Gonzalez Colon to veto the bill. LGBTQ Plus Federation co-director Justin Jesus Santiago wrote in a July 17th press statement, "Let there be no doubt, we will go to court to challenge the constitutionality of the governor's cruel and inhumane signing of a law that criminalizes health professionals for caring for trans minors."
New Hampshire's Republican governor, Kelly Ayotte, vetoed two specifically anti-queer measures and three more culture war bills passed by the Republican-dominated state legislature. House Bill 324 would have barred schools from distributing books and other materials deemed harmful to minors. That catchphrase has been used to censor books with LGBTQ plus characters and themes. It also would have required school districts to enhance procedures for parents to challenge materials. Ayotte said that current state law already covers those concerns. The governor called House Bill 148 overly broad and impractical to enforce, potentially creating an exclusionary environment for some of our citizens. It would have allowed businesses and correctional institutions to segregate people by sex assigned at birth rather than gender identity, including for facilities like restrooms and locker rooms. Former Republican Governor Chris Sununu had also vetoed a similar bill. Ayotte also vetoed bills to make it easier to get religious exemptions from child vaccine requirements and to require parental permission for non-academic student surveys, according to the New Hampshire Bulletin. An anti-choice measure that would have mandated that sex education courses include images that showed the development of the heart, brain, and other vital organs in early fetal development was also on Ayotte's chopping block. A two-thirds vote in both chambers of the state legislature is required to override gubernatorial vetoes. House Republicans don't have the votes to override any of them.
The Trump administration is being forced to restore $6.2 million in federal funding to nine queer and HIV organizations. Judge John S. Tiger of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California decided on June 9th that the plaintiffs were likely to prove that several Trump executive orders against diversity, equity, and inclusion were unconstitutional. So is a specific anti-trans edict. Lawyers for the queer advocacy group Lambda Legal representing the plaintiffs reported on July 15th that all nine had seen their funding restored. The plaintiffs were the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, the Los Angeles LGBT Center, the GLBT Historical Society, San Francisco Community Health Center, Prisma Community Care in Arizona, the New York City LGBT Community Center, Pennsylvania's Bradbury Sullivan Community Center, Baltimore's Safe Haven, and the Trans Supportive Forge in Wisconsin. In its announcement, Lambda Legal proclaimed, "When we fight, we win."
Finally, U.S. President Donald Trump should have learned by now not to mess with Rosie O'Donnell. The outspoken lesbian comedian and former talk show host announced in a March TikTok video that she was moving to Ireland and in the process of securing citizenship through family descent, but that she would maintain dual U.S. citizenship. Trump waited until he needed a distraction from his current challenges involving his friendship with the late convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein to troll O'Donnell. In a July 12th post to Truth Social, Trump declared, "Because of the fact that Rosie O'Donnell is not in the best interests of our great country, I am giving serious consideration to taking away her citizenship." Of course, the president does not have the legal authority to revoke the citizenship of a person born in the U.S. The O'Donnell Trump feud has gone on for almost two decades. It began when, as a co-host on The View in 2006, she ridiculed the future president's hypocritical alleged moral authority. O'Donnell responded to Trump's empty threat on social media this week. Of her decision to migrate, she said in part,
"It got sad and scary for me with the election of the current president, so I knew I had to take care of my kid, my non-binary autistic kid, and the way that people marginalize and attack the trans community, especially politically, is unfathomable to me and so unbearably cruel."
She went on to say,
"Don't worry about me. I'm good. I'm safe here in Ireland. I'm out of the reach of the Tangerine Mussolini. I have to say that I was expecting him to do something as absurd as he did for a few reasons. Number one, I read Project 2025. Number two, I've had 20 years of abuse from him, so I knew it wasn't going to stop. And number three, I know myself well enough to know that I wasn't going to shut up."
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude for the week ending July 19th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Joe Bainline. Stay healthy.
And I'm David Hunt. Stay safe.
This just in, Andre Hernandez Romero is out of El Salvador's notorious CICOT prison and back in his native Venezuela. The gay asylum-seeking makeup artist had not been heard from since he was wrongly swept up in the Trump administration's mass deportation campaign 125 days ago. His release was apparently part of a prisoner swap arrangement. Hernandez Romero's supporters now fear that he has been returned to the same life-threatening homophobic environment he was trying to escape. More details on this story next time on This Way Out.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Stop banning our books.
That's right.
Stop banning our books. Stop banning our books.
Books may not be burning yet, but the political heat in the U.S. is rapidly rising. Just how far is it from book bans to bonfires? In its mad dash to undo diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, the current administration is working overtime to pull LGBTQ+ and other marginalized voices off the shelves. You'll be hearing about an event sponsored by a venerable literary organization to illustrate the dangers, but first, one of its leaders explains why it's stepping into the breach.
We're a literary organization, we're a free expression organization, and we got into this work of tracking book bans in large part because we understood that if we were going to be an organization of writer members, of writers, if we were protecting their freedom to write, we also needed to protect the freedom to read and the freedom to learn and the freedom to teach.
You're listening to Allison Lee, the managing director for PEN America Los Angeles. And for This Way Out, I'm Jason Jen. PEN is an international literary club and community that's been in existence for over 100 years. With some original members like Radcliffe Hall, E.M. Forster, H.G. Wells, Willa Cather, Eugene O'Neill, and Robert Frost. Its main charter states that literature knows no frontiers and must remain common currency among people in spite of political or international upheavals. So they have a lot to say about current government censorship.
Since 2021, we have been tracking this explosive rise in book banning across the country. It is not incidental. It is not just a group of concerned parents here or there. It is a concerted effort that is well funded by groups that have their roots in white supremacy and Christian nationalism. It is now, you know, the explosiveness that we see in book bans last year in the 2023-2024 school year, PEN America tracked over 10,000 cases of books being banned across the country. I know it's a shocking number. And while like the biggest offenders of that might be in states like Florida and Iowa, they happen in every state across the country. State legislatures are now involved in it, but also it now has the seal of the highest office in the land. And with executive orders coming down almost immediately from the Trump presidency when they said, you know, book bans are a hoax, we are now seeing the Department of Education dismantling of K through 12 education. We're seeing, you know, we're seeing the ripple effects happen across not just in K through 12 education, but we're seeing words being removed from websites, the federal government. And so this is not just about education. This is not just about books. This is about a revamping of our public education system. This is about whose stories get to be told, what history we learn, and, you know, really the marginalization of LGBTQ voices, of Black voices, of women's voices, about stories, about who we are, who we want to be. And, you know, it's just not something that is acceptable in a democratic society.
What's the average medium of banned books on an, you know, like on an ongoing basis?
So I started in 2022, the first banned book week that I did. I think the number was closer to like 2,000 or 3,000. And then it went up to 5,000. It's been an exponential growth just in the 3 years that I've been at PEN America. There was no normal before this. I mean, books have always been challenged. Parents have always had the right to look at what's being taught in their kids' classroom and to look at a book and to be like, I don't know if I agree with this. I don't know if I like this. And there are systems in place for parents to talk with their teachers, talk with their principals, talk to their school boards about how to be involved with the development of their kids' curriculum or what's in their library. I think the misnomer here is like this parental rights concept, right? It's like, your parental rights don't get to supersede my parental rights in an odd sort of way. They're deciding for an entire community what can be on the shelf. If you don't want your child to read a book, by all means, have that conversation. By all means, be involved in your child's education. But to decide that for an entire community, to decide what can and cannot be available on the shelves, is, to me, you know, an invasion of my rights as a parent that feels very un-American.
There's this funny concept of like you're banning the book, but then they're bringing so much attention to it. Because, I mean, we're in a culture where people are reading less and less, and there's worse material people are going to see on social media and online.
Fear can be weaponized, and what a powerful motivator it is. And I think in this issue as well, they are taking a fear that might be true about kids growing up too fast, about mental health issues and social isolation and everything else that comes, you know, with the electronic age. And since they can't figure out what to do with these things, they're putting it, you know, on a book, which is just entirely misplaced. PEN issued a new report in Florida about this idea of parental rights, like the inverse, like actually all the ways in which parental rights have been limited by what is largely called a parental rights campaign. So books have always been challenged, right? The Bluest Eye, there's always been books that have been challenged. Judy Blume was, you know, and Forever, and Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Like, the books have always been, you know, challenged or banned or, you know, there's always been controversy. But what we started to see was this national movement. What we started to see in 2020, 2021, really coming out of COVID, coming out of the tension that was happening in schools, first around masking and then around like taking back the schools and taking back parental rights and the ed scare that kind of followed, this kind of national database that was tagging books and recommending the same books. So what would happen is we'd see a book in Utah and a book in Iowa and a book in Florida. It would be all of these different school districts would all of a sudden start flagging and challenging and pulling the same book. And the challenge was often worded exactly the same, down to the same typo, like the same typo in each challenge. And we realized that there was something else going on. And then the way you got from like 5,000 books in a year, which was like the 2022-2023 school year, to like this 10,000 is state legislatures started getting involved. So in Florida and in Iowa and in Texas and other states, it wasn't just a school district here or there that was making a decision. The state legislature was legislating what could or couldn't be taught. If I'm a librarian, if I'm a teacher, I could go to jail if I have this book on my shelf. So they just started pulling. That's when we started seeing, like in parts of Florida, like 10,000 books all at once got pulled from the shelves of this one school district in Florida, including like the Guinness Book of World Records, including like Beyonce's biography, including the dictionary. I mean, because if you think about the content in those books, it included topics, words that fell into this the legislation. So that's how we got to from like one or two here or there to then starting to see it spread across the country to now this exponential. And now with this current administration and the executive orders that have come out, what we imagine for 2024-2025 was kind of just off the charts.
So you're seeing these similar typos must be then in the same organization or the same limited group of people that are imposing this upon everywhere, everyone?
Yeah. What are we trying to teach people when we say that a book is dangerous? A word is so dangerous that it cannot be used. It cannot be on a website. We are so incapable of dealing with it that we must, you know, purge it from our lexicon of vocabulary, right? It is a dumbing down of our society. It is a number one play in the authoritarian playbook of like, what do you do when you want to control people? You control what they read, and then you control what's in what they read. And so, you know, it is the exact opposite of the freedom to read, or the freedom to write, or the freedom to learn that keeps a democracy free. That's one of the reasons why we're, you know, trying to raise the alarm bells on it and making the points of connection between, you know, the book ban in your child's classroom and the removal or the tagging or the flagging of words on government websites, or that you cannot apply for a grant if you use words like woman or pregnant people, or, you know, whatever else. People sometimes ask me, it's like, but the books are still available. Like the opposite part is true, which is like, but what are you talking about? Like, I can still get that book. It's not like the books have been disappeared or something like that. You know, I can get it on at my bookstore or on Amazon and whatever. And I do like to try and help people understand that this is about access points and public access to information. When you're targeting libraries and librarians and you're targeting public schools and teachers, you're undermining what has always been the foundational small d democratic institutions that have brought a citizenry together, that have given us a common language, that have helped us understand one another, have to be a country of immigrants and diversity and diverse experiences. And when you start taking away not just the diversity of experiences in the books that you're allowing, which is what we're seeing in the thematic aspects of books that are being banned, but that those seeds of distrust that they have planted about what your teacher teaching, what are they, you know, this idea that there's indoctrination happening.
So how does someone combat these types of influences from affecting the whole population and creating all of this censorship?
We need more people who believe in literature, who believe in the power of literature to connect, who understand that what children need are stories that allow them at that key developmental moment to build empathy and compassion. What young people need are stories in which they see themselves. You know, I was a teenager and a young adult in the 80s. And I have, you know, I'm an ally of the LGBTQ community. And I have a lot of friends who are both with us and not with us, who experienced a lot of pain because of how silenced and othered they were. And the books that they're objecting to and the books that they're banning are books that were written by an entire generation of authors who said no. I'm not going to let another person go through what I went through as a young adult. I want them to be seen. I want them to have knowledge. I want them to have power. I want them to have confidence. And it changes lives. And so we need people like that to be involved in their schools, like just to run for school boards, to go to the city council meetings and be the vocal majority that we know that they are against this vocal minority. So that's like grassroots organizing 101, right? We need to understand and support this idea that books and ideas are not dangerous, that that is not what is dangerous here.
Thank you to Allison Lee from PEN America Los Angeles for joining us to discuss their viewpoints on this important subject. For more information about banned books or PEN America, you can visit the organization online at pen.org. Visit thiswayout.org for our extended interview podcast link, and join us next week for part two of our Banned Camp exploration, where we'll hear from the event organizer, Hank Henderson.
I would like to have banned authors from Los Angeles, like Abdi.
And banned book author, Abdi Nazemian.
We always have to ask ourselves when we're shining a light on banned books, why are they banned? Whether it's because they explore and expose a history of racism in this country and in the world, or a guide to how to fight back the way our community did in the 80s and 90s.
For This Way Out Radio, I'm Jason Jen.
Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Joe Bainline and David Hunt and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was Jason Jen. Paul Simon, Joni Leeds, and George Michael performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks John Dyer V of Winston, Oregon, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on 2SER Broadway, New South Wales, KEUL Girdwood, Alaska, WRFI Ithaca, New York, and a wide array of community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.